Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's latest tweets as he doubles down, promising a major investigation into his bizarre conspiracy theory that between 3 and 5 million illegals voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election, thus robbing him of a victory in the popular vote. A nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation, Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss how the Republicans, who since the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, have been proactive and aggressive in pushing strict voter ID laws and other voting restrictions that Democrats and the courts have labeled as voter suppression, could somehow have allowed the Democrats to keep 5 million extra illegal votes up their sleeves for so long without saying anything about it? Then we will speak with Arun Kundnadi, who is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and the author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. He joins us to discuss Donald Trump's forthcoming executive order banning entry of Muslims into the U.S. from 5 countries the U.S. is currently bombing: Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. We will also discuss the absence on the list of countries from which perpetrators of domestic terrorism came or from where attacks were planned, launched, or financed, such as Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Then finally, we'll examine the creeping authoritarian nature of the new presidency of Donald Trump, where already signs of censorship, propaganda, fake news, alternative facts, lies, intimidation, and a thirst for adulation are emerging. Kevin O'Leary, a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of Trump and the Roots of Rage, The Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat, joins us to discuss Pope Francis's concern expressed about the rise of populism in the United States and Europe, warning that, quote, Hitler did not steal the power, his people voted for him, and then he destroyed his people. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as the founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
Thanks for having me.
And Donald Trump sent out a tweet, and of course they usually date stamped something like, I think this one is around 4:10 a.m. in the morning. I will be asking for a major investigation into voter fraud in caps, including those registered to vote in 2 states, those who are illegal and even those registered to vote who are dead, and many for a long time. Depending on results, we will strengthen up voting procedures. Now, he is doubling down after having made this statement to the so-called Big Eight, the top leadership of the House and Senate, and that was leaked by some of the participants there who were apparently in total dismay about this same claim that 3 to 5 million people had voted in the elections illegally, or he called them illegals, had voted, and thus robbed him of the popular vote victory that Hillary Clinton won by about 3 million votes. So what do you make of this sort of doubling down on something that's already been dismissed as a conspiracy theory?
Well, the most plausible explanation I've heard for why he tweeted this out this morning was that it came just a few minutes after a report by Ari Melber on the Today Show on NBC television, in which Melber made the point, as many others have made, that if in fact it were true that millions of illegal votes had been cast in the election, that would be a national crisis, and it would call for a major investigation. And yet Trump couldn't be serious because he hasn't called for a major investigation. A few minutes later, after that report aired, these 2 tweets came out calling for this. And so I think this was simply a response to the earlier statements he had made, and it doesn't seem like it was necessarily well thought out in terms of what the investigation might look like. But that seems to be what the origin of the major story of the day has been.
But how could you have, as I mentioned in the opening, the Republicans were very proactive and quickly out of the gate when the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. They have been aggressively involved in pushing strict voter ID laws and other voting restrictions that Democrats and the courts have labeled as voter suppression. So given that, how could they somehow have allowed the Democrats to keep 5 million extra illegal votes up their sleeves for so long without saying anything about it?
Well, it's just a ridiculous statement. And I have just seen a clip of an upcoming interview that was posted that's going to be on ABC television, in which Trump claims that of all the millions of supposed votes that were cast, none were cast for him. So all the fraud occurred to hurt him. The idea that 80% of the non-citizens in this country would be out voting, that they would do so in a way that was impossible to detect, even in Republican states with Republican secretaries of state and their stricter voting laws, but that this great conspiracy would not lead to Hillary Clinton's election, that is, they couldn't get 10,000 more votes in Michigan or 70,000 more votes in Pennsylvania, it's just a ridiculous statement. There's no empirical evidence to suggest even thousands or likely even hundreds of non-citizen votes have been cast in this election.
And the reference to dead people voting, that in itself would be a miracle. That would make Lazarus look pretty lame.
Well, I think what he means there is people voting in the name of dead people. This is a very common
right.
claim that's made.
But
when those are investigated, those turn out to almost always be administrative or voter error. So, for example, someone signs on the wrong line in the poll book, and it looks like the person who has died has voted. Or there's a senior and a junior, and the senior has died, and junior votes, and people think it's senior that's voted. Now, there was a very sensational story out of South Carolina about all of these dead voters supposedly voting. Got a lot of attention. Months later, after the investigation, there wasn't a single verified claim of an intentionally fraudulent vote that was cast in the name of a dead person.
But I thought in most places you have to show some ID, and I can't imagine how a dead person could show an ID, or even a person as an imposter could show an ID.
Well, no, that's not true. There are many places where you do not need to show an ID, including California. There are requirements to show identification if you vote for the first time and you've registered by mail without providing your driver's license number or the last four digits of your Social Security number. That's a federal law that requires that identification. But the way that when occasional dead voters voting happens, in the rare occasion, it is usually an absentee ballot is sent to a home. The surviving spouse votes for the spouse who's deceased in the way that the deceased spouse would have wanted to vote. Not a vast conspiracy, still illegal, but not a problem on a large scale.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Hasson, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Well, we also learned today, by the way, that Stephen Bannon, Trump's chief strategist, has been registered to vote in both Florida and in New York. And just before this last election, he canceled his registration in Florida. But my understanding is, I've heard reports in this about this before, that if there is any voter fraud, some of it is to do with the so-called snowbirds, the people in the north that go down to have second homes down in Florida, where they can vote by mail in one state and show up in person in the other. Presumably, if it's in the winter, which it normally is in November, then it would be in Florida, having posted their votes in whether they're in New York or Minnesota or wherever. And the assumption has always been that snowbirds are reasonably wealthy people who have second homes and therefore may well be Republicans. Have you heard that story?
Well, let's start with the question of whether or not Bannon and some of the others who are registered, supposedly registered in two states, are committing fraud. I would guess they are not. The much more likely explanation is that the person has moved to change residences, but that the election officials have not caught up and deleted the registration of the person or where the person used to live. In addition, in terms of how much double voting there is, it is true there have been cases of people voting in two states. There have been cases of the snowbirds, as you mentioned. There have also been cases of people, for example, who live in one Kansas City and vote in both Kansas cities. There are these occasional cases. The number of these cases is very small. And in fact, just maybe an hour ago, on my election law blog, electionlawblog.org, I posted a brand new study that was just sent to me looking at the rates of double voting across the states. And it finds that the rate is extremely low, less than 0.02% of the votes cast, and probably lower than that. And this study finds that if, in fact, we aggressively tried to match voters' names across state lines, we would make so many more errors that we would eliminate 200 valid registrations for every one that would prevent a double vote. And so it's not costless to try to catch this. And we know that the stricter you make the rules in the name of trying to prevent the small amount of fraud, the more likely it is you intentionally or not suppress the votes of legitimate voters who are caught up in an administrative error.
So again, there's no way in the world that all of these possible and plausible and perhaps, you know, common efforts to suppress the vote come to nothing, because the reports I read recently were that I think there, in the last election, there were only two cases detected, and they were both in favor of Trump.
Well, I'm sure that there is more fraud than two votes in the country.
Right.
But I'm also sure that a conspiracy among 3 to 5 million people, 80% of the non-citizens in this country, across the country, everyone voting for Hillary Clinton, but not enough in Pennsylvania, this would have been detected. It's just beyond belief.
Well, but apparently the source of it, at least the speculation, is that it's Donald Trump's friend, this extreme character, radio host Alex Jones, who's sort of, I mean, he's considered right-wing, but he's also the progenitor of the Truther conspiracy about 9/11. So I don't know how you'd paint him politically, but he's out there on either the extreme fringe of the left and right, or indeed where those two fringes meet. But nevertheless, for some reason or other, our new president finds this fellow credible. He's the guy that, by the way, that insists that the Sandy Hook massacre of those schoolchildren was a false flag operation designed to have the government take our guns away.
Well, I don't know if that's where he's getting his information. There was just a story posted in the last few minutes at the New York Times website about Trump telling a story to these congressional leaders about a German golfer, Bernard Langer, who had supposedly told Trump that he had seen instances of non-citizens voting while he was online to vote. Well, this guy's a German citizen. He wasn't even voting. And so the whole thing is based on an anecdote that turns out to be incorrect. So maybe it was a story about his friend. Mr. Langer's daughter said that the quote was, he's not a friend of President Trump's, and I don't know why he would talk about him. So I really don't have any idea as to where the information is coming from, but it does not seem to be credible information.
Well, then the only conclusion, or there are two conclusions. One is that there's an other agenda here, which I'd like to talk to you about, or the other supposition which many have, which is that Donald Trump is a little unhinged. But let's assume that that's not the case and go with the idea that there is another agenda here. What could it be? I mean, in other words, so there's some speculation that by having this major investigation that he's claiming that he wants to pursue and initiate, would that, do you think, have a situation where if you're looking for, even if it's mythical and completely fictional, if you go after 5 million, 80% of undocumented people in this country, that in itself is a form of intimidation, isn't it? Is that the subtext? In other words, to further muddy the waters about this idea of minorities and other people illegally voting and therefore further the atmosphere of intimidation, make people less likely to want to register, etc.?
Well, I think it could be something more direct, which is that it could be the predicate for passing a national voter identification law. It could be the predicate for passing stricter laws involving voter registration, stricter laws involving early voting. There's all kinds of things that could potentially be done to make it harder on a national level for people to vote. And there is that indication in the tweet that you read at the beginning of our conversation, where Trump says, if there are problems found, we're going to come up with solutions. Well, those solutions might tend to make it harder for people to register and vote without good proof that they're needed to actually stop any appreciable amount of voter fraud.
Well, I believe that after 9/11, there was some call for a national ID card based upon the idea that there needs to be an inventory of who is in this country in order to determine who shouldn't be in this country. And lots of countries have national ID laws, and the objection here from civil libertarians has been largely that you don't want to have a situation where the Gestapo comes up to you and demands to show me your papers. But in a way, it seems to me, I'm doubtful whether Donald Trump wants to do it in a way that would eliminate all of this nonsense about registering and all of the impediments that only in America do you have about voting. Mexicans, I think, have a voting ID, a national registration card, and they vote easily without any having to register, and they vote. I think in some countries you automatically are put on the rolls when you're 18 years old. In Australia, for example, you're fined if you don't vote. Is there a way to make a national ID card such that you wouldn't have all of this patchwork of voting laws, all of these restrictions, and that people would be able to vote in the United States so much easier than they do now?
Sure. I've long called for a compromise of national voter identification card where the government proactively has to go out and register everyone and pays all the costs associated with getting the underlying documents and creating exemptions for people who can't produce those documents, and couple that with automatic voter registration so every eligible voter is registered to vote. I don't think there's a lot of support for that. There's parts that the left don't like, parts that the right don't like. But what I'm envisioning is not something like that, but a law that requires you to produce a state ID, maybe a list as we see now in these stricter states, where the kinds of IDs that are allowed are the kinds of IDs that those who are likely to vote Democratic are least likely to have, poor, minority, students, elderly. And so it is, not a well, at least from what I've heard so far about the possible efforts in this direction, it's not a well-thought-out effort to make sure we enfranchise everyone and have a rational, uniform system. If it were that, I think there could be some support, but I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
So you think it's going to be more along the lines of what they did in Texas, where if you had a gun license, you could vote, but if you had a student ID, you couldn't? In other words, selective discrimination against people who are likely to vote Democrat.
That's right.
So, in other words, it could be an opportunity to get rid of all this nonsense, but it's not likely to happen. That's the conclusion.
I certainly don't expect it to happen now, not in this atmosphere,
right,
and not with these kinds of unsubstantiated allegations being raised.
So what's your sense then in assuming that when these tweets stop and the executive order is revealed, what do you think can be done? I mean, the courts did, for example, down in North Carolina, they talked about African-American voters being targeted with surgical precision. And these were, by the way, I think Republican appointees. So to some extent, the courts have, even though the Supreme Court struck down the important Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, a lot of the courts around the country have resisted these strict voting restrictions that are likely to be enhanced by Donald Trump.
Well, it's true that the courts have been pushing back, but I would not count on that continuing. Assuming that Donald Trump is able to get a new conservative member to replace the deceased Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, it could well be that you will have a five-justice majority that continues to give the green light to these laws. Just this week, the Supreme Court, which is now has eight justices, four liberals, four conservatives, did not take up the Texas voter ID appeal that Texas was bringing. But Chief Justice Roberts went out of his way in a kind of unusual way to issue an opinion saying, just because we're not hearing the case now, the case is ongoing, and we reserve the right to look at all the issues when this case comes back before us after it's finally concluded in the lower courts. So I would not count on the U.S. Federal courts, the way they're going to be shaped by President Trump, being necessarily the kind of backstop that we've seen them be in the last few years in these in this area.
So just in closing, maybe there's a method to Trump's madness.
I am not a psychoanalyst. I can't tell you what the president is thinking. I can only look at the actions. And right now, all we have is a statement that there's going to be an investigation. And we'll just have to take it one step at a time.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Hassan.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of the leading casebook on election law, and he serves as the founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal. And his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing Donald Trump's forthcoming executive order banning entry of Muslims into the United States.
You don't need to change. The future's odd. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arun Kundnani, who is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He's the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain. And his latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arun Kundnani.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously, much of the headlines today, it's somewhat hard to keep up with Donald Trump, both in terms of executive orders and the tweets that he puts out. But most of the oxygen today is being taken up with Donald Trump's announcement of building this wall, which he's promised for forever on the Mexican border. And it we could spend a lot of time talking about the absurdity of it and the practicality of it. But nevertheless, the other aspect of his plans that there's a leak of a draft of an executive order on banning Muslims, specifically from Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, Iran, and Sudan. That's not entirely proven yet that it will be what he's going to do, but I think the chances are pretty solid, are they not, that within the next day or so, there will be an executive order banning refugees from those countries and immigrants, indeed, and even relatives. Is that your understanding?
Yes, it is. Yes, as I understand it, that would be a ban initially for some temporary period of time. We don't know how long, but and it would apply to refugees as well as any other kinds of visitors, family visitors, students, any foreign national from those countries who's hoping to be able to enter the United States.
And what's the understanding then of people that are already here? Will that maroon them? In other words, if you're a student over here from one of those countries, if you were to go home, you couldn't come back in? Is that the situation?
I mean, unclear at the moment on details like that, but certainly the fear would be that this is the beginning of a wider process where foreign nationals from those countries and potentially other countries in due course will be not only prevented from entering the United States, but those already in the United States on visas will be removed, which is something that already we saw after 9/11 under the W. Bush administration. Thousands of foreign nationals from Muslim-majority countries were forced to leave the United States in the first couple of years after 9/11. So we could be seeing something similar happen now. And, you know, I mean, I think it's hard to imagine a greater kind of hypocrisy around the list of seven countries that have been released today. Five of them are countries that the United States is currently bombing, that is Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. And so we are exporting violence to the Middle East. Last year, we dropped something like 22,000 bombs in the Middle East in those five countries. And then the results, the consequences of that violence that we are exported, one of those consequences is that refugees will want to leave those countries and seek sanctuary. Many of, overwhelming majority go to neighboring countries, Jordan, Lebanon, huge numbers of refugees from Syria and Iraq. And yet we then close the door to them here when they seek sanctuary in a country that has a huge responsibility for creating that very violence in the first place.
Well, it's even more complicated when it comes to Iraq, because U.S. military personnel are in there both as advisors and up front with special forces in the battle for Mosul. And just a few days ago at the CIA, Donald Trump said that he'd like to redo the Iraq war, but get it right this time and take Iraq's oil. So if you're an Iraqi national, a patriot, fighting with an American to liberate your country from ISIS, surely when the President of the United States says, we're going to steal your oil, that puts the American soldiers over there in jeopardy, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the, you know, I don't think that the particular individual statements of Donald Trump are going to change the security situation in Iraq for Americans or anyone else that much. I think it's more about, you know, Iraq. I mean, I think what we don't understand in the United States is, you know, Iraq is a country that has been devastated through decades of war, largely the result of U.S. foreign policy. You know, the war in 1991, the sanctions policy through the 1990s, 2003 war, which the aim of which was to destroy that society. I mean, that was the explicit aim of it. And the Iraqis have worked hard and struggled to try and transform their situation, to rebuild their country. And yet we are still involved in sponsoring violence. We are still supporting an authoritarian regime that carries out sectarian violence. And we've stopped paying attention to what's going on there. There's very few journalists reporting on Iraq anymore, certainly with any depth. Most of them are just recycling Pentagon press releases. So, you know, we then cannot be surprised when huge numbers of people are forced to leave that country. And we cannot be surprised when people in that country believe that it's legitimate to use violence against the United States' presence in the Middle East. We cannot be surprised when there is outrage in the Middle East and many other parts of the world around the kind of double standards and the hypocrisy that the current refugee policy symbolizes. And just to kind of, you know, I think it's important to understand that even, and this is not just about Trump, I mean, the policy before Trump came in under Obama was also pitifully limited in terms of the numbers of Syrian refugees that were being allowed into the United States, given how much of that turmoil in Syria is a spin-off from the wars that the United States launched a decade ago. So, you know, this is a long-term bipartisan problem. Trump has obviously intensified the situation. He's using rhetoric that is much more explicit in targeting Muslims, in targeting Arabs, in presenting the Middle East as this place that is inherently a threat. But it is something that is a long-term problem, both in the Democrats and the Republicans.
And again, I'm speaking with Arun Kundnani, who's a professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University. And his latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Now, conspicuously absent from this list, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and Iran and Sudan that are likely to be banned from coming to the United States with an executive order by Donald Trump that's expected in the next few days. The countries missing, of course, are Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, both of whom have been the source of much of the domestic terrorism attacks here in the United States, either those that perpetrated them, including the shooters out here in San Bernardino, came from both from Pakistan. The woman was trained there in a jihadi camp and was also influenced in Saudi Arabia, where the marriage between the two was set up. And that's just one example. And, of course, the other shooter down there in Orlando came from Afghanistan, which is not on the list as well. There doesn't seem to be any consistency in that, is there? I mean, what's your reading on the inconsistency?
Well, I mean, firstly, the only consistency on the list of countries is that they are all Muslim-majority countries. There are major Muslim-majority countries that are not on the list in terms of the Middle East, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are the kind of obvious large countries that are not on the list. And the reason for that would presumably be that those are key allies with the United States, and large numbers of people who are among the elites of those countries, military personnel, intelligence agency personnel, government personnel, corporate elites, travel to the United States frequently for reasons to do with business and to do with shared military and intelligence operations. So it would have been much more problematic to imagine a restriction on those countries. But, you know, this is early days, and where this goes is not clear. There is no objective criteria. I mean, if we were going to try to devise some kind of formula for countries around the world that are producing a risk of nationals of that country coming to the United States and committing acts of violence, it's not clear to me that any of those countries on the list would actually be near the top. 9/11, the leader, you know, was actually coming from Germany. The majority of acts of political violence in the United States take place, are carried out by Americans against other Americans. The idea that the problem of terrorism requires us to shore up our borders doesn't really stand up to the data. So, and you know, there is very little reason. I mean, I don't know of any cases of anyone traveling from Somalia, Libya, Yemen, Iran, Sudan to come to the United States to commit acts of terrorism. So this is not based on any kind of evidence of actual risk.
Well, here in Los Angeles, which is often jokingly referred to as Tehrangeles, there's an enormous Iranian diaspora, and it covers quite a range of political thought in Iran. But the bottom line is that many, many Iranians return to and fro to Iran in the way that Cubans do now, to go to Cuba. And the same theory applies. I mean, here we are talking about opening up Cuba by allowing relatives to go back and forth and open more ties and therefore eventually create kind of more of a democratic opening. So I don't understand why the same doesn't apply to Iran. I mean, you know, why prevent people from going to Iran who represent, by definition, the liberal faction as opposed to the reactionary IRGC and the supreme leader faction that control all the levers of power through the military and the intelligence services and the militias, etc. So I don't get the logic there of preventing Iranians from returning to Iran who would, you know, perhaps play some role in liberalizing that country.
Well, I think over the coming year, we're going to see a very different kind of Iran policy from the Trump administration than the one that Obama has pursued. And I don't think that the kind of soft kind of logic that you've just been describing, that was very much associated with Obama, of trying to kind of gently nudge Iran in a more liberal direction through things like travel relations between the countries, trade with countries, and so forth. I don't think that kind of thing is part of Trump's agenda. I think he's going to be much more confrontational. I think we will see a ramping up of rhetoric. I think we'll see a ramping up of alliance building. I think the aim will be to isolate Iran from Russia, isolate Iran from Syria, and undermine Iran's kind of strategic position in the region in that way. Maybe bring on board the Saudis and the Gulf regimes as in a new alliance with Syria to confront Iran. And so the kind of approach that you're describing is going to be alien to the approach of a new administration.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, in terms of the wall on the Mexican border, you know, one of the suggestions is that Trump's going to pay for it by taking money away from sanctuary cities. And the whole point of sanctuary cities is that the police don't want to cooperate with the ICE immigration people in scooping up immigrants in raids, because the police want to have communications with the community and have the ability to have people in the community single out real crime and real lawbreakers. And that's the logic of it. And so it seems to me that the idea of building a wall in that regard is counterintuitive, and that it also applies to the same kind of police and intelligence strategies that are used within the Muslim communities here in the United States, where the police and intelligence services rely upon local people who identify somebody that's becoming radicalized and perhaps dangerous. And that is the first line of defense that the U.S. has in terms of so-called domestic terrorism. So, again, I fail to see the logic here.
Well, firstly, I don't think that the funding will work out in the way that it's being talked about, because the cost of building the wall will be astronomical and won't be funded by the defunding of sanctuary cities. And I don't think the aim is to reduce crime or any of these ideas that are being presented as the purpose of these policies. The aim is to change the demographics of the United States. It's an ethnic cleansing policy, not a crime reduction policy. And therefore, the kind of trade-off that you're talking about in terms of intelligence on crime and in terms of relationships with communities is a price that I think the Trump administration considers more than worth paying. So the aim is to essentially create a situation where if you are undocumented in the United States, and currently, you know, you have already been in a very vulnerable situation, and you know that there's a real chance that you will be deported, you're unable to access all kinds of services and so forth. But the aim now is that that people will literally be hunted down and they will be unable to interact with any kind of agency, with any kind of employer. The purpose will be to make it impossible for anyone to escape deportation. And this is, as I say, I think the aim is a kind of ethnic cleansing to gradually reduce the number of people who are not white in the United States.
Make America white again.
Precisely. I mean, I think we should be honest about, you know, the agenda here. It is a racial agenda. I don't think anyone can be in any doubt about that at this point. And, you know, whether you're talking about the treatment of immigration across the Mexican border, whether you're talking about the approach to the Middle East and Muslims within the United States, whether you're talking about the agenda in relation to Black Lives Matter and the idea that this is going to be a so-called law and order administration, all of it is about upholding a certain kind of racial politics, upholding a certain kind of white identity politics. And, you know, I think that's what underpins the whole structure of this administration's policy program.
Well, Arun Kundnani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Arun Kundnani, who's a professor of media, culture and communications at New York University. He's the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain. And his latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism and the Domestic War on Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the creeping authoritarian nature of the new presidency of Donald Trump.
Right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kevin O'Leary, a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. He is the author of Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America, and his latest book is The New Authoritarian Threat and What to Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin O'Leary.
Nice to be on, Ian. Thank you very much.
And thank you. And during the inauguration of Donald Trump, Pope Francis did an interview with El País, the major Spanish newspaper, where he expressed his concern about the rise of populism in Europe and in the United States, warning that, quote, Hitler did not steal the power. His people voted for him, and then he destroyed his people. Now, obviously, the word fascist and fascism gets bandied around rather loosely, and we're not I'm certainly not going as far to say that Donald Trump is a fascist, but signs of creeping authoritarianism are pretty manifest.
Yeah, I would agree. And you could just look during the end of the campaign when he was, you know, saying he wouldn't abide necessarily by the outcome of the election when he thought he was going to lose. And also another thing that's very anti-democratic is when you question or challenge the civil rights of your political opponents. So the whole thing with having his crowds and himself chant, lock her up, about Hillary Clinton. There's just a number of things that he does as when he addresses his public, you know, that are anti-democratic, and that should concern everybody. It's just not healthy at all.
Well, but the attacks on the press, which are increasing, seem to me to be very, and they happened throughout the entire campaign. And of course, it's a huge irony that the same press that he attacks and calls disgusting, etc., and sometimes singles out reporters who then get threatened by his crowds, the same press that he attacks gave him $5 billion worth of free advertising, free media. So it's pretty extraordinary. But I think that there's a clear strategy there, that by waging this rhetorical war against the media, he's delegitimizing one of the few institutions that can hold him accountable. And that's, you know, on the one hand, his own supporters love it because they already hate the media and think it's a liberal cabal. And so he's able to just spew lies, which become truth to his supporters. And when the press try to pull him over, you know, he's able to bully them, which he did in his first press conference. So I think that's more than creeping authoritarianism.
Yeah. I think your analysis is quite correct. I should say one thing about the my book is forthcoming. It'll probably appear in the fall, The New Authoritarian Threat. So just to let people know that. The attacks on the press, yes, they're disturbing. You're right. It is one of the central institutions that holds people to account. It's interesting now, there was a big debate at the end of the election and during the prelude, you know, the walk-up to him taking the oath of office, about whether the press should use the word lie. You know, and the Wall Street Journal editor came out and said he wanted to be very careful about it, and others were saying, you know, they do it so much that we need to communicate with our readers. And so it's interesting, now that he is president, you've got the New York Times and others putting the word lies or lies in their headlines to let people know. I mean, just this first week about the whole, you know, hubbub about crowd size, which was partially to distract the media away from, you know, the overwhelming tide of humanity that turned out for the Women's March all over the country and the world. And then the whole thing with, you know, he's at an evening event with Democratic leaders as well as Republicans, and insists on there was 5 million votes stolen somehow, and it's just these outright fabrications. He lives in a different universe most of the time in terms of facts, and so that's very disturbing, because how do you have a democracy? It's hard to have a democracy when you don't have a basic set of facts, and we're an enlightenment country. We come out of the idea of science and facts, and so the press is really trying to deal with how to cover him, because they know they're under attack.
Well, you didn't even use the word lie. You said fabrication.
Yeah. So we're such in the habit
he's got to
be, because for most politicians, you don't label them liars because it has that connotation of intent.
Right.
But it happens so often, right, with the Trump people and Trump himself, there is intent.
But he can blatantly lie because he knows that his base trusts him more than what he calls the dishonest media. And that's been proven by a poll where I kept wondering, why is he saying what a fabulous victory, what a massive historical landslide? And then you learn that most Republicans believe that he won not just the Electoral College vote, but the popular vote as well. So it does
right.
work.
Right. Yeah, and it just, I mean, what's dangerous to all of us is if that support for Trump and that willing to believe the lies that he and his administration tell, if that creeps up over 50%, we're in big trouble. I mean, for most people, we thought we have a two-party system, and we're protected from the dangers of extreme parties that they have in Europe and Israel and other places in the world, where you can have a situation such as Hitler, where his party, the Nazi Party, had like 2 or 3% in 1928, and then 1932, because of the Great Depression, they end up with low 30s. But Hitler never got close to 50%. He was able to take power and become the chancellor with 32%. Trump, we thought, was going to stay in the low 40s, given all his insults against everybody. I frankly was surprised. My one big surprise in the election was I thought women, some of the women that were listening to this, that were moderate Republicans, would go in the voting booth and turn against their party because of the candidate that they picked. And, you know, 90%, roughly 90% of Republican women returned to the fold. So they stayed with him. Right now, his popularity is low, and he does have this base of one-third of the country, but it's really important that base does not, or that percentage of the population that is open to this fabrication, lies, distorted truth, whatever, right? these outright fabrications and lies, that percentage doesn't grow. That's really important.
Now, you've worked for Time magazine. One of the most amazing things that speech that he gave at the CIA, which a lot of former CIA officers thought was absolutely obscene, in front of the wall of their fallen heroes.
Right.
He went on to say, you know, that I've been on the cover of Time magazine like 14 or 15 times. I think it's an all-time record in the history of Time magazine. Of course, the all-time record is held by Richard Nixon, who appeared 55 times on the cover. But then he went on to say that the military gave us tremendous percentages of votes. We were unbelievably successful in this election with getting the vote of the military, and probably almost everybody in this room, meaning the CIA people there, voted for me. So that's when I get a little afraid, is when he talks about this legitimacy that's not real, that he makes up this support from law enforcement, the intelligence community, and the military.
Yeah.
All of which are the adjuncts of an authoritarian leader. So he's already claiming that they're on his side. So he's sort of already given himself license to be another authoritarian leader.
I mean, it is disturbing that he's picked so many generals for his inner circle. We just have to hope. I mean, partially what happens when you have democratic breakdown, one of the best scholars on this was one of my professors at Yale, Juan Lentz, and he wrote a series of books with others about the breakdown in Europe in the 30s and what happens in Latin America a lot of times over time. And one of the keys is, how does the party and the people that, you know, are have been drawn in to support this new regime, do they stand by their old principles, or do they become apologists for the new authoritarianism? So it's going to be key how the Republican elite react. I mean, it's been heartening, because we're looking for glimmers of hope, that McCain and Lindsey Graham and others have voiced concerns. But it's going to take more than that, and we certainly hope and pray that the long-standing military tradition in the U.S. of, being a very clean and honest military maintains, because it would be awful if some of the generals had authoritarian ideas. That would not be good.
Well, I guess based upon what I'm reading from the CIA people, maybe it didn't work there, because it was pretty ridiculous that he was whining about the media not giving him credit for this imaginary crowds that he had at his inauguration. And that, of course, story hasn't gone away. But in general, it just what scares me about him is that his lies aren't necessarily there to deceive, but they're there to sort of, you know, separate his followers from his detractors, from the believers, mm-hmm. from the disbelievers, mm-hmm. and he's going to reward his people and punish the latter. That's what his legislative agenda is about. You know, he's just right. taking an absolute thrill at punishing people. And by the way, you know, it's not even punishing liberals and rewarding conservatives. It's people who pay homage to him and genuflect before him, like Jeff Sessions, the first and only senator to support him. He gets rewarded. He's now the attorney general. So that's how the game works. This is a combination of political hardball and just unctuous flattery.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, partially it's going to depend on the liberals picking their battles and winning, because a lot of what happens with new presidents, irrespective of you know, just going across, not just Trump, but any new president, is how they do the first 6 months, 12 months. Do they build political capital in the sense, do they win some key victories and impress people that they know what they're doing? And so to speak, build their chits, their poker chips, and then they can do other things. Or do they run into some real problems? Now, you know, in a sense, the Affordable Care Act gives, given what he's promised and the difficulties it's going to be in reforming and repealing and reforming and coming up with a replacement, that's an opportunity for the Democrats. They're going to have to play it really well. If the Democrats, following the indivisible guide and on all the protests and all the energy on the liberal side, rise up and do as well as the Tea Party did in 2010 and maybe more, then politicians will notice that in Washington, and the Democrats will get spines. We have to hope that the Democrats hang together in all this and block some of his things. So he needs some losses. The liberals need to defeat Trump on some key areas where the battle's close and the press is looking at it saying, who's going to win? And the liberals are going to have to win some of those. If they do, that will slow his progress down. That's really crucial the first 6 months.
Well, the big battle will be the Supreme Court, and that's going to happen within weeks, I believe. He's going to put forth a nominee, and it's likely, given how in-your-face he's been so far, it's likely to be Pryor or one of these really hard right guys.
Yeah, and there's a place where the Democrats have, I mean, that's a place where Trump may overplay his hand, his judicial people may overplay, because I understand that's a place where it is going to be 60 votes. Now, there's some things that the new administration will be able to get through just on 50, but, you know, it's one of those things that when you're in the minority, you say, thank God for the Senate and the supermajority situation. And so are they really going to be able to get, you know, eight or whatever Democrats to go over to support a hard right nominee? We certainly, I don't think so. I think he's going to have to moderate whoever he gets. And does he want a couple battles? Does he want to do like Nixon and put a couple people up to rouse his base, to show that he's really with the base on putting up a Scalia-type person? That's going to occupy a lot of oxygen. And if he ends up losing a couple times before he has to concede and put up somebody more reasonable, that's extremely valuable. And maybe the Democrats should just say, look, you stole this Supreme Court seat. We're not approving anybody. I mean, I'm game for that. I'm fine for that. Because the real question here, the deep question here is what your point you're getting at about the legitimacy of Trump and the danger that he's authoritarian threat that he represents. It's not just him, it's the party. The whole party has shifted to the right, so much so that they're far past conservative, and I like to call them illiberal as a middle term. They're not quite fascist in the European sense, though Bannon and some people like that are certainly making connections over there. But the whole Republican dominant majority in Congress, Paul Ryan, McConnell, Pence, and Trump, and all the rest, they've moved over to this illiberal position that's very anti-government. Government's bad all the way around. And it's got a lot of racist tones from the Old South, and it really is anti-American. I think this is one thing the liberals should use to point out, and I do in this book, that the new right that we have now, this illiberal right, is based on old Europe's norms of four things. The aristocratic old world was based on privilege, hierarchy, inequality, and exclusion. And America waved goodbye to that. Jefferson followed John Locke and all our founders all the way through Tocqueville and Lincoln and the Roosevelts and Obama and Republicans like Eisenhower and Bob Dole and even Nixon. They rejected the old world view. But the new right that we have now, this illiberal right that's especially formed after Gingrich took power in the House in the 90s, is strongly illiberal, and their platform endorses privilege, hierarchy, inequality, exclusion as the norms, which were the norms of the Old South. And it's explicitly there, and so we have to fight that. Maybe if we frame it that way, it will help.
Well, the ultimate nightmare is a global authoritarian club led by Donald Trump with Vladimir Putin, Marine Le Pen, Viktor Orban, Nigel Farage, you name it. That is a growing threat. And the one thing that they can dismantle is the rule of law. And once they dismantle the rule of law, then you've got, a government by oligarchy. You already got a cabinet of oligarchs. So we're not that far away from a government by oligarchy. In fact,
right. And what we want to be careful is Tocqueville had this brilliant thing in Democracy in America where he said, look, constitutions are just pieces of paper. What's critical, yes, are the laws, but what underlies the laws and the Constitution are democratic norms. So that's what's frightening and really concerning about Trump, because he wants to disregard all the norms that came and just say, I can just make up anything. That is a sign of a true authoritarian autocrat. And back to my point I was going to make before, let me make it explicitly now. The question facing us is the question of legitimacy. And you'll have a lot of people saying they're a little bit naive because they're not quite understanding the threat. Well, he's the president. We have to give him a chance. He won the election. He won the Electoral College. And they're just kind of ignoring all these signs, explicit check marks, check of being an autocrat and favoring authoritarianism. Well, so to question his legitimacy. The question is, do we give him legitimacy? We own our legitimacy, and he has to earn it. So he's behaving this way. We have to challenge him.
Well, Kevin O'Leary, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Kevin O'Leary. He's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. And his forthcoming book is The New Authoritarian Threat and What to Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.